Welcome to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine.
I'm Scott.
You just jumped in there.
Well, because you weren't, you paused. You're speaking so slowly.
I took a pause and you jumped in.
You took a pause and looked at me anticipatorily.
It's a podcast about movies and wine. And for those of you who don't know shit about one or both of those things, I'm Jamie. I'm the movie guy. I'm not the movie guy. I'm the wine guy.
Boy, this is a disaster. Somehow an even worse intro than last week's, where I lost both all sense of what I had to say and how one forms a sentence.
Yeah, me too.
He's Jamie. He's something. I'm Scott. I'm something else, I guess. And we're here to help you. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves. And sometimes I like those wines, too.
Sometimes. We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. We usually don't. Last time we did, though.
Did we?
We agreed on Bedrock being good with Midsummer.
We thought it worked okay. Yeah. We thought it worked fine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't recall you being terribly enthusiastic.
I wasn't hugely enthusiastic, but we did end up agreeing that it worked
well enough.
Yes.
But what about today? Do we think it works today? Let's just cut right to the chase, Jamie. I think it's a weird one. I went contrapuntal, and I think it works contrapuntally. But it only really starts to work about a halfway or about half an hour into the movie.
Interesting.
Yeah. Like I had a sip in like the first 5 minutes. I'm like, we're going to let this sit for a minute. And not to like let the wine aerate or whatever, but just was like, I know where the movie is going.
Right.
And once we get to like the parts where it's not like mud caked and grungy and you know, there's foliage all over. And like once they get into Portland, then I was like, all right, now the wine is working for me.
I will say that in that first 5 minutes, 5 or 10, I want to eat that mushroom tart.
That he makes for the pig?
That he makes for himself.
The pig gets some, too.
The pig gets some, but
he doesn't just let the pig, like, clean out
the pan. He cuts himself
a
slice and eats it with his hand.
And the pig gets some, too.
Yes, the pig gets some, too.
And I don't even like mushrooms.
Mushroom tart. So good. So we talk a lot about food on this show. Scott has complained loudly about the fact that I usually don't give him pairing suggestions for his wines. And then on mic, I will claim that the wine will taste better with food. And that is a reasonable complaint, Scott.
Thank you.
I thought that maybe we should talk about the thing that wine is supposed to go with.
Food.
Not movies, but food.
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 So I put together a list of some of my favorite Philadelphia restaurants and contacted the owners to see what dishes they wanted to showcase.
And on the movie side of things, to kind of piggyback on what Jamie's doing,
piggyback. I get it.
That was an accident, and I tried to commit to it. I picked 6 movies that, in one way or another, explore the power of food, specifically meals that are shared. And I do think that that concurrent theme comes to a full head with this week's episode and selection.
Fully agree with that.
When I decided I wanted to do a food thing, pig was the first thing I thought of because pig...
Pig is about shared meals
and
the power of meals.
Pig is about that scene in Ratatouille where Anton Ego eats the Ratatouille and then flashes back to his childhood. It's just that for 90 minutes and sad.
Yeah, it's a little bit about that. Makes sense.
It's that.
So for the fifth dish... I contacted Judy Nee, who owns Baology. That's Baology. Baology. It's a Taiwanese street food restaurant. And aside from being absolutely top-notch takeout and delivery food, they're sourcing seasonal local ingredients. Judy is a leader in the Philadelphia industry in the ethical treatment of her staff and also has done a lot of work for charity and specifically during the pandemic, feeding hungry industry people. I just think the world of her. And aside from her being an incredible person, her food is fucking delicious. And she created a whole new special just for our show when I approached her. She didn't pick something off of her menu. She wanted to do something timely and seasonal. And so she was waiting for the good late summer corn to come in to hit us with these curried crab Shenzhen bao with corn and jalapenos. So the wine I chose to go with this is Schramsberg Blanc de Blanc 2018, which is available as of this recording at Crush Wine Co., for $32.
Now, this is a sparkling white wine.
That's right. Don't do a champagne.
I wasn't going to do it.
Don't fucking do it.
I retired that joke. I don't do it anymore.
And you see how it still makes me mad from the past?
Well, that's all I need. That's what matters. I don't even need to do it. That's how good the joke is.
God damn it.
It lingers through time. Well, about this here Schramsberg Blanc de Blanc, Jamie told me that the wine was tropical, delicate, regal, energetic, and sparkling, to which I paired 2021's Pig. Pig, a film written and directed by Michael Sarnowski, a screen story by Sarnowski and Vanessa Bloch. It stars Nicolas Cage. It is a beautiful, quiet, internal, contemplative drama about food and isolation and grief and family and a pig. And
a very cute pig.
It's a very cute pig. And it's a top-tier Nick Cage performance, and it was one of the best movies of last year. And right now you can stream it on Hulu or get it on your VOD service of choice, but you should watch it because Pig is wonderful. And it is a beautiful 91 minutes long and does an awful lot in those 91 minutes. Pig, big fan. Well, Jamie, before we get into the food or the wine or the movie,
we have our usual carrot and stick business.
Carrot and stick segment. Do we have a new review, Jamie?
We do not have any new reviews.
We have no new reviews.
Because all of you out there are failing us.
Well, I mean, not all of them. Some of them have left us reviews, and they were very thoughtful and helpful.
I take it back. Many of you are failing us.
Yeah. So if any of you had left us a new review as of this episode's recording, you would get the carrot, which is you could leave us in your review your favorite Marvel movie, and I would make Jamie watch it. And by make, I mean Jamie would just voluntarily do a thing he doesn't want to do, and then he gets to spend like 10 minutes complaining about it on the next episode. But since that hasn't happened, here's the stick. Yet another update in my ongoing saga to renovate my bathroom.
I am so excited.
Well, this is ripped from the headlines. This just happened yesterday.
Yeah, and Scott tried to tell me this off mic, and I was like, nope, save it for on mic so that I can be a supportive friend to you listening to it for the first time.
Instead of a shitty friend to me listening to it the second time.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's great. Well, so if anyone is paying attention on bated breath waiting for the latest updates, last week I teased that the next big thing I had to do was install a new faucet. Well, yesterday I did it. New faucet went in. Black, beautiful, 4-inch, 3-hole center set faucet. It's handsome.
It's nice. It looks good.
The spout is kind of tall, but there was a bit of a struggle. As I have previously detailed, Jamie, you are acutely familiar with this, that the bathroom is very small, hence me hating it so much.
And we're big guys,
but the toilet is immediately facing the vanity. And the toilet itself is basically in a stall where a big guy like us is just about shoulder to shoulder to the wall. And the vanity itself is 18 inches deep, which is too big for the space that it's in. And this is only really acutely a problem if you, for example, need to get into the vanity cabinet with your head and both of your arms to reach inside up and under with a basin wrench to remove the previous faucet, and then install a new one.
Yeah, that sounds like you were doing some contortionist work there.
Well, so off and on for about an hour yesterday, I was laying on the floor of the bathroom with my head, just my head, inside the vanity cabinet because it's a two-door vanity cabinet, even though we can't store anything in there. It's fine. Just my head laying on a towel in the cabinet, contorting my arms to like one each go in like each of the cabinet door areas to reach up and install and remove the thing, but with my feet on top of the toilet bowl.
Oh boy.
So just laying on my back, nope. Legs up.
Hate it.
Head up there. And it was extremely difficult and very unpleasant. And the job was finally done. And then I realized I had to go back and fix a whole nother thing. But I did it all without breaking any pipes.
Or breaking any of yourself.
Yeah, I did, however, at one point, my sneakers, because I'm very large and not particularly agile, and this is a very, you know, small space, my sneaker did streak across the wall that I only painted a few weeks ago, and I thought it was just like a line that would wash off, and in fact, it actually damaged the paint, and I have to do some paint touch-up once again. So, yeah.
Oh, man.
It was great. My wife, a true sign that she loves me, did not take any photographs of me in this truly humiliating and very uncomfortable contorted position yesterday.
I would like you to know that had I been there, I absolutely would have taken photographs of you.
And not helped at all.
No. I would have just stood there like eating popcorn, heckling you.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like any fun. No, it wasn't fun. Renovate your bathroom, folks. That's the takeaway
here. Now I like my bathroom more, though. I hated it before, and now, I hate it a lot less now. Hmm. And it's better now. It looks better, and it's a little bit more functional. It's mostly just that it looks better, though.
Yeah.
And I like it more. And it's a fun project, and it's been, you know, it's a skill builder project. Well, anyway, if you hated this segment and don't ever want to hear about bathroom renovations ever again, good news, I'm basically done renovating my bathroom, but next week I do start painting the child's bedroom, and before I do that, I have some drywall to repair and some ceiling light fixtures to take out, and I have to learn how to remove my baseboard heaters that we don't use anyway, and hopefully I don't electrocute myself in the process, so no more bathroom. But
there's plenty of opportunities, so leave us a review.
Please leave us a review.
And maybe I'll watch the fucking Snyder Cut or some shit.
Oh, man, that would be really mean.
So someone out there has it in them for that cruelty.
They're out there, Jamie. There are Snyder Cut stands out there, including respectable people who I quite like.
Do you think any of them listen to this podcast?
Johnny Words.
He likes the Snyder Cut?
Johnny Words liked the Snyder Cut.
Ooh, Johnny Words. I have never seen it, but I'm just going to assume it's a bad take.
Johnny Words, I swear to God, Jamie, he described it as a tone poem. He is closer to right than you think he is.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Okay.
Yep.
Please don't make me watch the Snyder Cut.
You suggested it. I think you want to. No.
I don't want to.
I think you want to.
I
want to
be very clear. I don't want to watch that movie. I do kind of want to watch... Fucking the Avengers, the one that you said was your favorite.
The one that I like, Age of Ultron?
Age of Ultron.
Well, someone has to suggest it.
I do kind of want to watch that.
Most people don't like that movie, though.
You've said enough good things about it that make me want to watch it.
Well, you'll probably think it sucks because it's not as good as Black Widow.
Well, Black Widow is an artistic masterpiece.
Yeah.
It is a tone poem.
All right, we have to move on.
The food
was good.
Yes.
The special is not available as of this recording.
And
it is coming soon.
Coming soon, and I really have to point out, I love the attention to detail here. We don't want to put on a special with anything less than the best quality local corn. Like that's the whole thing at Biology.
It's true.
We actually rearranged the order that we were doing this miniseries in because of certain seasonal ingredients. And Southwark was able to get tomatoes in a little bit early, but the corn was still not quite right this week. It's going on special next week.
Yeah, I've had plenty of summer corn so far, and it's been good, but we're not there yet. We're not at peak corn. Summer corn.
And Judy is an exacting lady.
I love it.
So, you know.
Cannot wait to eat them.
The bow that she normally does are the like sandwich style, almost like hot dog bun bow. And those are great. We love those. We had some of the short rib ones and the tempura fish ones. And those were spectacular. The
tempura fish bow was outstanding.
But Shenzhen bao is a type of soup dumpling. So this will have some gel in it that when heated up becomes soup. And it's a fully enclosed bao as opposed to the not fully enclosed.
I don't know that I've had a soup dumpling, but in a bao bun before.
Bao is a blanket term.
Oh, okay. It's not just for like the fluffy kind?
Correct.
Okay.
It generally in America, it is that. And I'm not 100% sure because the Shenzhen bao is not one that I'm intimately familiar with. But apparently it comes from specifically Shanghai, and I'm excited to eat it with curried crab and corn and jalapenos.
That just sounds
so good. We just ate lunch and I'm hungry talking about it.
I'm kind of hungry again. But yeah, so we had the short rib bao and the tempura fish.
The tempura fish bao, and we had the Taiwanese fried chicken.
Yo, that was so good.
Even though you dropped sauce on the ground.
Well, there were two sauces and it just like slid. It fell. I didn't mean to, and I'm very upset about it.
Yeah, because that was the spicy sauce.
But it was spicy. It reminded me of like a not sweet, spicy lemon pudding or like a lemon custard.
Yeah, there's definitely like a ton of lemon zest in there. It was super good.
Beautiful texture. It was so good. And it is the great tragedy of at least
the last 2 hours.
Yeah, that we lost half of that sauce. I was very upset because I'd have gone to town on that sauce with a spoon. I'd have done it.
Yeah, same. Yeah. It was very good sauce. The last dish that we had was a shrimp ruan bing. And a ruan bing is a Taiwanese wrap. They look cosmetically like a burrito, except it's like a rice paper wrap and it's got rice and chopped vegetables and shrimp in there. And your wife likened it almost to like a Peking duck or Mushu flavor. And yeah. I agree. It's got like a plum sauce kind of thing going on. Mm. And that was fucking dope.
It was super aromatic and the texture was great. And it wasn't just that the vegetables were chopped. It was like they were, I don't know, carrot and zucchini, but it was all like thin slivers. That's julienne.
Yeah.
Okay. That's julienne. But yeah, just like a beautiful mix of like color and textures and God, it was so aromatic. Yeah. And
it was a good lunch.
Those little scrimps in there too. It's delicious.
Beautifully cooked shrimp.
Yeah.
Cause you can overcook shrimp. Yes.
Yeah.
This was not.
I embarrassingly, I only learned fairly recently how not to overcook shrimp.
Really?
Yeah. Which is just don't cook them for that long. Just like, are they pink? Brilliant. Great. They're done. It was great. Since we had 4 dishes here, Jamie,
mm-hmm.
This will recreate one of my favorite things to do with my wife, who is not present.
Oh boy.
Which is rank the dishes.
Ooh, rank the dishes.
So rank the dishes of the 4 things that we had today.
To start off with, they're all superlative. I like them all a lot.
All were great. That's
but
correct.
I think from top to bottom, number 1 for me is the short rib bao. Mm. It's the thing that I have ordered a bajillion times from Bowlegy. It now just like tastes like home to me, and I fucking love it with the like crispy shallots on top. It's just so good. And then the Ruan Bing, which was new to me, and I love it. I will absolutely be ordering it again. Then the fish bao, which was also great and shockingly, like really, really survived the trip very well. I was a little worried about it.
About the fish? Yeah.
It's tempura.
Well, like I said, not just the tempura, but even the buns themselves, like
right.
They were still fluffy and they hadn't, you know, because the thing
and they had
if,
that,
if they're in a takeout box for too long, it gets
soggy,
sweaty, or it gets too dense and feels doughy again. And these were perfect.
I agree. And then last was the fried chicken. And that's not to say that the fried chicken was anything other than great, but it's the last on my list.
Yeah. I would have gone, my number one would be the tempura. The tempura bao
fish
was outstanding. And then the Ruan Bing. Which, oh God, it was so good. I can almost imagine it again. The texture. Oh, all the textures and the flavors. It was so good.
It's really good.
And then the chicken, in part because I loved the texture and the crisp, but then that sauce.
That sauce
really elevated the whole thing.
And then the
short rib.
Wow. So wine.
Yeah, we should probably open this bottle.
Yeah.
This Schramsberg.
Schramsby.
I'm not opening it. Don't look at me.
I'm not looking at you expectantly. I'm just, you know.
You're just looking at me.
I'm in a really comfortable position. You know, I've got my feet up.
Open
and
the wine. We need to drink the wine. You have to open the wine. You are wine boy. Get us wine. It's got them bubbles.
Love them bubbles.
Would we? This is a fine bubblation, right? These are small bubbles.
Yes.
These are not large
bubbles.
These
are fine bubbles, yes. Due to the method champenois.
I thought this was method traditionnel.
Same thing. Oh, Scott's doing the I'm mad about a wine thing
no,
face.
It's just, why does everything in wine have to have at least 2 names?
Well.
These are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is in the Champagne method, which is the same as the traditional method.
That's right.
But this is not from Champagne.
That's correct.
Because this is from Germany?
No, this is from the
Austria?
Napa Valley, California. Yeah, so Schramsberg was, the estate was originally founded by a guy named Jacob Schramm, a German immigrant who purchased land in the Napa Valley.
Schramsberg.
Yeah.
Possessive.
Berg means mountain in German. So it was Schramsberg, Schramms Mountain.
Mm.
But yeah, the wine I think is fucking dope. You were saying Tani got wine all over the place when she opened it?
There was, you know, it happens. It was a bit of an accidental champagne bottle discharge.
I would just say to all of our listeners out there, try not to open, if you can help it, sparkling wine that is not cold. Carbon dioxide stays dissolved better when it's cold. And so it doesn't come out of solution when you relieve the pressure, which is what will happen when you open a warm bottle of champagne. Same thing that happens when you open a warm bottle of Coke or Pepsi.
The carbon dioxide comes out of solution.
Yes.
So the carbon dioxide, when it's bottled, is liquid.
It is dissolved, yes.
And then over time...
It's not liquid. It is dissolved in liquid.
So it's like a sediment?
No.
It's just atoms.
It is,
molecules.
Molecules that are hydrogen bonded to water.
Hydrogen bonded. Okay.
Yeah.
But then at room temperature, they come out of solution, and then that's where all that extra pressure and the popping comes
that's
from.
That's right. The bubbles that you're experiencing are carbon dioxide molecules coming out of solution. That's what carbonation is. He's blinking. He's giving me a slow blink.
In truth, I've never really given it that much thought before.
Well,
I knew that they were bubbles, and I guess conceptually I knew that it was carbon dioxide, but beyond that, I never really gave any thought to the science of what they are and what they're attached to.
Right, and that's
and
fair.
And how they change.
The weird thing about it is that, like, contrary to most solutes being dissolved in a solution, carbon dioxide dissolves at lower temperatures, whereas most other things dissolve at higher temperatures. Like, if you're going to dissolve sugar in water, you want your water to be at a higher temperature for that to happen quicker.
Jamie, you have to say that again.
Why?
If I want to dissolve what in what?
Sugar in water? Sugar in water.
There we go. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That
took me a minute to get what you were putting down.
I'm a little embarrassed that you forgot about one of the great on-screen performances of all time. Bubbles. Small bubbles. You said tropical. It's a little there's a tropicality
like star fruit, to it. Grilled pineapple, like papaya thing going on.
Mm. The texture is very nice.
Like a green papaya. You ever have a Thai papaya salad?
No.
Those are so good. Oh my God.
Thai papaya salad? That sounds good.
Because it's like shaved underripe papaya, and it has like a really good crunch, but it still has that sort of that tropical fruit flavor.
Mm.
Super, super delicious. And I think that is present here.
Mm.
But it's also got that roasty, toasty, like brioche, bready, yeasty thing as well.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm getting the yeasty thing. It's nice and crisp, medium plus acidity.
Medium plus, yeah.
Medium plus acidity. I'm salivating a little bit here.
Yep.
Not too much.
Not too much.
A reasonable amount of salivation station.
That's right.
There's some bitterness to it. Is that a bitterness as a result of tannic compounds?
I don't think so. It's not really getting much bitterness.
Bitterness, but a flavor of bitterness, not a texture of tannin.
If there's any bitterness here, I would attribute it to Lee's aging, the contact with the dead yeast cells.
Okay. I'm less interested in that. Just a confirmation that there is a scotch of bitterness. I am once again, as with last week, with the
Bedrock
Rosé that we drank with Midsommar, getting hints of bitterness that are reminiscent of dark baking chocolate.
Hmm.
Yeah, like a crisp apple thing. Not quite a green apple. When it was chilled, I was getting more of a green apple thing.
Right.
And now it's
now
more
it's
of
almost
a,
like a Macintosh.
Like a Macintosh or an autumnal Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Adam. Apple.
Every time I have the Schramsberg wines, I love them. From the Blanc de Blanc, they do one called Mirabelle that's mostly Pinot Noir, that's a rosé that's super good. They do a Blanc de Noir that's also fucking delicious. And then the like top cuvée. The one that's released years after production is called J. Schramm as a nod to the original owner of the property. And that is like as good or better than many champagnes. It's really, really spectacular.
You know what I like about this wine? And this is why, and we'll get into it when we get into it, but why I think it is a nice pairing with pig. Would you describe this as an unpretentious wine?
There is pretense here, but I think it's only because I know about the history of it, this is Napa Valley royalty, and like there's a lot of like grandiosity that is ascribed to this wine. But yeah, like blind, I think you're right.
Right. Well, because I'm not talking about the makers and the history and the land and the T word. I'm talking about the thing in the glass. And sometimes with your sparklings and your fancy ones, and just from the label and the Frenchified names, I could tell that this thing could have been putting on some airs. But then I have it in the glass, and it is not at all afraid to taste good.
Right.
And I find that sometimes with these things, like some of the wines you have selected for this show, I feel like they're embarrassed to taste good. They're like, we have to be so fancy and whatever that they're just like unwilling to actually taste good. And it's like, well, you have to admire the complexity and think of the, it's like jazz. Think of all the good tasting notes that they're not making you taste like. And this one just tastes good. It's interesting and it's complexing, yes, and there's a lot of things going on, and it's crisp and there's bubbles and there's like a scotch of a minerality thing going on, but it also has nice, enjoyable flavors that I like. And I appreciate that. Thank you very much, wine.
I can agree with that. And I can agree with your previous statements about some wines being having that, like putting on airs, like being afraid to taste good.
Which one was it? What was it? The fucking rosé in the last miniseries that you were so confounded by.
Finca Torre Milanos.
I feel like that was one of them. Where
that was the only rosé that miniseries.
No, but one where you were like, oh, why don't you think it tastes good? And I'm like, I don't know, because
it doesn't.
It doesn't taste good. Like, it's interesting, but I didn't find anything likable about that one.
I still maintain that wine is really delicious.
Right, but you know, you like suffering for your wine.
Wow.
You like the shit that tastes weird.
I do.
And you enjoy the weirdness.
That's true.
And you enjoy the things that are challenging.
Mm-hmm. And I enjoy those things in a genuine way. But right. I do understand
the
difference between
airs.
That and this, which is just kind of viscerally
good.
And, you know, to quote one of our favorite television shows, it's good for all time zones. You just chugged that glass of wine.
Because it tastes very good,
you,
Jamie.
Like, just... down the hatch.
I didn't chug it.
It's, I gave you like a 6.5 ounce pour.
Is that
and
a
it's
lot?
Fucking gone.
All right. Well, it was good. I'm sorry.
No, you shouldn't be sorry. You should. That's great.
I'm just getting loaded up because the next bottle is very small. There won't be as much wine.
That's very true. But okay. So speaking of a little bit of the pretense about this wine, it was the first commercially produced Chardonnay in the Napa Valley.
Have we talked about this before? Schramsberg Blanc de Blanc sounds familiar to me.
Schramsberg has come up when we were talking about other sparkling wines because you were talking about like what other sparkling wines of the world are there that taste like champagne or that like do champagne things. And yeah. I like this is a touchstone for me.
So this was the first commercially produced sparkling Chardonnay?
Just Chardonnay.
Commercially produced
in the United States.
Domestically. Yeah. Okay. Because previously Chardonnay was only the province of some French province.
Right. And it took a while for it to get planted in any, you know, significant way here in the United States. So this wine, the Blanc de Blanc, was poured at Richard Nixon's A Toast for Peace in 1972 with then Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai, which absolutely led to years of peace between the United States and China.
Well, yeah.
And has continued to be poured at White House dinners under every administration since.
Well, Jamie, it is a well-known ancient Vulcan proverb that only Nixon could go to China. Star Trek 6, baby. I quote Star Trek 6 whenever I can.
I didn't even know that that was a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Only Nixon
could go to China. It's when Spock is trying to convince Kirk to essentially be the ambassador to Klingon Gorbachev to, you know, negotiate peace talks and dismantling the neutral zone / bringing down the Iron Curtain.
Cool.
Only Nixon could go to China.
Only Nixon could go to China.
Yeah.
Well, it definitely worked.
Yeah.
There is peace in our time.
Yeah. We dismantled the neutral zone. All is well.
Yep.
Yep.
The wine is good, though.
Very tasty.
I really like the wine.
Nixon made a great choice.
He really did. Or whoever his like head of protocol that actually like sourced the wine.
Mm-hmm.
I also really love this one. Like, this is another one of those wines that has followed me through my career because like the level of quality with this wine, if you wanted an equivalent level of quality in champagne, you would have to pay at least $20 more.
An equivalent level of quality?
Yes.
And so are you paying import costs or is it just the brand name?
It's both. You know, champagne does different things from this, right?
Even though this is in the champagne method.
It's grown in California. There's California sun here. Don't say it.
California raisins? I heard it through the grapevine?
Yeah, sure, that. No, the other thing.
But so this wine has California is what you're trying not to say.
Yes, that's correct. No, it tastes like it was grown in California, which is, I'm not going to do a thing on
I'm not trying to do the bit. I just like you're talking about the California-ness of it all.
Yes.
So verbalize it for me, Jamie. This versus your stock comparable champagne,
right,
also made from Chardonnay.
A Blanc de Blanc champagne that costs $52 as opposed to this, which costs $32.
Okay.
Roughly equivalent quality. However, this is richer, riper, more tropical, less sharp. And whereas this is medium plus acid, a champagne would be high acid.
And that's the sun? Is the sun's doing a lot of that work?
The sun and the general heat of the area.
Mm.
Napa is a hotter place than Champagne is. Champagne is, well, it was at the northernmost, you know, limits for where we thought grapes could be grown, but now they're growing great sparkling wine in Kent and Sussex in Great Britain. But yeah, it's a champagne will be more mineral driven. This is not a particularly mineral wine. It wasn't in either of our descriptors for it. And I think
it's a little though.
It has a scotch
of minerality.
It certainly isn't what's driving the bus here. Right. What's driving this wine is fruit. And that for me speaks to, you know, what the growing conditions are in California.
And a willingness to let things taste good.
And that too. So yeah, it's a good wine. I like it.
It's very numerous.
And I will, you know, over the course of my life, probably drink a whole bunch more of it.
Now, a Blanc de Blanc.
Yes.
Have you explained what that means on the show before?
I don't think so. We've talked about Blanc de Noir. Have we?
I don't know. But
we've definitely talked about the fact that sparkling wine, white sparkling wine can be made and frequently is made from red grapes.
Right, because of maceration or the direct press. Or the other things. We talked about that very
because
recently.
Because the flesh of most grapes, is white.
Right.
And the way you get color is by macerating with skins.
Because you get them skins. But right. So Blanc du Blanc, white from white.
White from whites.
White wine from white green grapes.
Yes.
They're not white grapes, Jamie.
They're referred to as white grapes.
Who refers to them that way?
All like everyone who grows them and makes wine.
But not the people at the grocery store when I buy them and they're packaged and it says
well, those
green.
Are fucking Thompson seedless, man. That's not Vitis vinifera. That's not winemaking grapes. No one makes wine out of Thompson seedless. Those are eaten grapes.
But the grapes are green.
Yes.
Are the red grapes called red because they make red wine, or are they called red because of the color of the skins? Because
they make red wine. The color of the skins is mostly black.
Except when they don't make red wine, right?
And even the grocery store grapes that are black are called red grapes.
They're more of a purple.
So then why aren't they called purple grapes, Scott?
But if they're called red grapes because they make red wine, then why are the green grapes called green grapes?
Man, you just got some real Jerry Seinfeld energy.
I just don't understand. All of the vocabulary you people use is entirely arbitrary. You are picking and choosing what things apply at what given time.
Don't look at me like I'm the one who came up with this shit. I'm just living
here. Based on the country and on the region.
Because it turns out that language is different from place to place, as though we didn't know that.
Shut up. I think it changes from episode to episode of this show, too.
Sometimes, yes.
I have never heard you say white grapes before
you
on this show.
You absolutely have heard me say white grapes before. That you're just selectively remembering things.
Probably.
Yeah.
Because it's easier than trying to reconcile all the contradictory shit you say all the time.
Dude, they're white grapes. I don't know what the fuck to tell you.
They're green. They're green grapes.
Would it make you happier if I would refer to them from here on out as green grapes?
Yes.
Well, that's not going to happen.
White wine from white grapes.
That's right.
So that's the only reason this is called a Blanc de Blanc.
Yeah. Because generally sparkling wine is a blend of white and red grapes. The champagne blend is typically Chardonnay, Meunier, which is a red grape, and Pinot Noir, which is also a red grape. And so to make a distinction between, you know, one that is exclusively Chardonnay or one that is exclusively a blend of Pinot Noir and Meunier, they say Blanc de Blanc or Blanc de Noir. And then there are rosés and then like all kinds of other shit. It's not that hard. You're like getting mad over the difference between white and green. Just accept that they're called white grapes.
It just feels like sometimes with wine, the decision to describe based on a color is completely arbitrary.
Yes. Well, these decisions are also not made by the same fucking person. Nor are they made by one person. This is just how language evolves.
I feel like I understand rosé more clearly now. Because when we talked about rosé last time, I had this, like, lingering quibble that I didn't really want to get into too much, but about how I felt that there was this arbitrary distinction where your red wine comes from red grapes and your white wine comes from fucking white grapes, apparently.
Uh-huh.
But that I felt that the wine names were describing the grape and not the product. But then rosé doesn't come from rosé grapes. Rosé comes from a blend or a whatever or a direct press halfsie. What? But no, apparently it's just all up in the air. It's just all chaos. Sometimes the color is describing the product and sometimes the color is describing the grape, but it's not actually describing the grape because it's actually describing the color of the wine. I'm done with this. I am tired of this. You're acting like this is perfectly normal.
It's normal to me.
It's tiresome.
Just to set you at ease, it does frustrate me also. Because
I'm not feeling that from you.
I know,
right,
because
now.
It's fun.
I'm
it's more fun for me to just be smug.
Own here.
No, I'm frustrated too because, wine at every turn. The more and more I learn about it, the more and more it seems like it is set up in a deliberate way to be opaque, to be difficult to understand.
Yes.
To be exclusive.
Yes, it does feel that way,
and that may well be true. It's annoying and it's hard to give people straight answers about things when there aren't straight answers. And that is frustrating. And so I'm with you, but also I find it funny when you're upset. You find it funny when I'm upset.
Refill my glass. I need more wine. Refill.
Oh, man. And we're done talking about wine, I think. At least
I have another glass here
for the moment. Yeah, Scott is done chugging the first 7 ounces of wine.
It's not a chug, just because I
fucking
drank it
beer bong of it
quickly. I just drank it
in front of me. He shotgunned a whole bottle.
And you can't do that with a bottle.
No, you can't.
That would just break. I would just get glass in my mouth. That would hurt. It's very yummy,
ain't it?
It's very good.
I like
you,
it.
Are you're 5 for 5 this miniseries so far with me?
Yeah, I've
liked every wine this miniseries.
I changed tack on radically from last series.
You stopped trying to be provocative?
Yes. I was testing your limits and also being very self-indulgent.
Yeah. Now let's talk about pig.
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 I like pigs.
But you didn't like pig. Very unexpected. I thought this would have been the easy slam dunk with
you. We're going to get into it.
Pig. Pig. A 2021 feature film, Pig, written and directed by Michael Sarnowski. A screen story by Sarnowski and Vanessa Block. The movie stars Nicolas Cage as Rob, a shaggily bearded hermit living in the woods on the outskirts of Portland. His only companionship is his beloved truffle hunting pig. But when unseen assailants break into his cabin, steal the pig in the dead of night, Rob, assisted by his truffle buyer Amir, played by a truly wonderful Alex Wolff, must return to civilization and scour the Portland fine dining scene in a somber search for truffles that might lead him on the trail of his missing pig. Pig was distributed by Neon, they of impeccable taste Neon, and received nearly universal praise upon release. It got Nicolas Cage the best reviews he's gotten in years, and it won an Independent Spirit Award for its screenplay. Pig is currently available to stream on Hulu or wherever you get your VODs. I highly recommend that you do that, because Pig, it's very special. Jamie, well, before we get into it,
okay.
Spoiler warning.
Spoiler warning.
This is not a terribly plotty movie, but it is a very emotional movie, and a lot of the emotional resonance comes from the backstory of Rob, the Cage character, as it is slowly trickled out to you over the course of the film.
Right.
So here's your spoiler warning. If you haven't watched Pig, I recommend that you go watch Pig. Even if you know all the spoilers, it is still a resonant and, I think, very beautiful and profound experience. But this is your warning. Here endeth the spoiler warning. Jamie, I'm surprised you didn't love this movie. He's a fucking chef, and it's all about restaurants and the fucking power of food and restaurant experiences. So I'm very surprised.
I will say that there's a lot that I do like about this movie, and I think that it is a good movie.
Here we go.
I would recommend that other people watch it. It's not a thing that I, like, you know, am going to gnash and whine about. Just get into it. Like, the barrier that gets erected for me, or the barrier that I couldn't get past in enjoying this movie, is essentially the same barrier for me with The Irishman.
Okay. This is a movie that I recall you liking quite a lot.
But I have a problem with it. It's just another story about desperate, poorly adjusted white men.
Okay. Yes.
Like, this guy had a really successful career, and then his wife died, and he left society to be a truffle hunter in the woods and decided never to talk to anybody again. Like, that is an extreme reaction for anybody. And it's an extremely privileged reaction from a white man. Like, some people just can't leave society.
You're really surprising me, because you took the side of the douchebag boyfriend with Midsummer, but now you're against the fucking fine dining established food professional here who deals with his suffering in a tragic way. You're really unexpectedly, or you're really surprising me with how you're applying your Jamie Brand.
This is just
progressive
how,
values.
How it hits me, and I'm watching this movie, and I'm like, it lacks the ring of truth for me, especially, like, you know, having interacted with a ton of chefs in my time, the idea that any of them would or could just up and leave it all behind, especially at that, like, the man, we're led to believe, literally shaped the entire Portland dining scene. The mere mention of his name opens doors everywhere. My friend is Robin Feld. Done.
The Robin Feld.
Right. All he has to do is look up at the chef in that one restaurant, and he sits down and has a glass of wine with them. And all he has to do is remind that chef of the thing that he said, 15 years ago, and he reduces the man to tears and makes him chug a glass of wine.
Do you have a problem with that scene? Because that scene is incredible. Wow.
I have trouble with the idea that this incredibly accomplished chef, not Robin, the other guy, hadn't ever contended with the idea that he had different expectations for his career and is so blindsided by being reminded of it. You don't go into fine dining on a lark. You don't try to achieve the peaks of culinary excellence lightly. So the idea that he had forgotten that he once wanted to open a pub seemed a little silly to me.
You've never worked with anyone who, like, sold out because they wanted to follow market trends? And
that's not selling out, though. That's the thing. Fine dining is not where you make money. The top of the quiz, you don't make money doing that. You become a very successful chef, and then you make money by selling out on your reputation based on that. Like, the sellout comes after the critically acclaimed restaurant. The sellout comes after the Michelin stars, comes after the James Beard Award. So the selling out isn't devoting your life to a singular pursuit of excellence. That's what you do based on your passion.
This is unexpected. I'm not going to say it's a nitpick, because you have a different perspective on the restaurant industry, especially the fine dining industry as it's presented here, but my experience of people and of the world and the way that, like, business operates, it doesn't seem to me to be a far cry that someone who had one dream and he was in a city like, and I don't know much about Portland, but, like, the movie's version of Portland as presented, like, is there's a lot of fine dining and haute cuisine, and that there's a lot of pretense and airs, and it's a lot of money, right?
Yep.
And it doesn't feel to me out of character for human beings, for someone in that community living in that space, to abandon their more less pretentious, slightly humble. Less humble, but like less ambitious goal of like, I want to open up a pub, like a traditional English pub, because the trend and because financing and investors didn't want to support that. Like this is like a version of you don't like it because you wouldn't have done that, or like because you can't empathize with the character. Well, like that, so that is not a problem
we,
for me.
We
with the
veered
movie.
Into that particular character, and I do maintain that I think it doesn't seem resonant to me in a real world that someone would deviate that far from their original plans without having thought about it. That's the thing. Like
you don't think he thought about it?
He clearly is blindsided by the fact, I mean, I guess he's blindsided by the fact that Robin remembers first.
He's blindsided that Robin remembers and that he's being confronted with it.
But like,
but all of his dialogue is like, did I say that? Did I say that to you? But he's in complete denial. Because then when Robin said, what was your signature dish going to be? And it's immediately there. He has full recall of it.
Yeah.
He's repressed it. It's been 15 years since he gave up on that dream and followed this other path. Emotionally, that scene is like one of many like knockout emotional scenes for me in the whole movie.
For me, it didn't resonate because it doesn't seem feasible to me that someone would have followed this path that is so incredibly demanding of your time and your attention and your passion, really your passion to create something beautiful and excellent without having contended with abandoning a more humble dream.
I mean, he clearly has contended with it in some way. Like he is haunted by, this is so funny that we're focusing on this guy who has one scene right. in the movie.
It's a scene with impact. There's a record scratch when Robin, you know, drops that he remembers this prep cook from that worked for him for 2 months that he fired.
Because he always overcooked the pasta.
Well,
he gives you like, that scene gives us like one of the, it follows up the breakfast scene with Amir, like right before that. But it's talking about what we care about. When Robin says, we don't really get a lot of things to care about. And then in this scene, he's talking about how this food, this restaurant, these customers, the critics, none of it's real. Like, so here's the thing about, I forget the name again.
Finway.
Here's the thing about the Finway restaurant, right? Like you're talking about somebody, it doesn't make sense to you that somebody would abandon their dreams in the search and the struggle to create something so beautiful. Robin does not think this is a beautiful restaurant, right? Like Robin turns his nose up at the food. I don't fully understand when he squishes the whatever thing, like he eats the scallop.
He eats one and then
he squishes the other one. And I kind of feel like he's turning his nose up and he can tell just from the look of it and the texture of it that it's overcooked.
Yeah.
Perhaps just like the pasta.
He's judging it.
This is a pretentious fine dining restaurant. Even just the waitress and her presentation of the meal and the description and that it's local and we're trying to use local ingredients and make them seem alien. And it's all presented in the smoke of a whatever. And Robin sees right through it and sees that it's just bullshit.
Yep.
You must have been to a fine dining establishment that has this level of prestige and says all the right things and has all the right ingredients and cooks their food and presents them in smoke and as foams and as nonsense. But there's a lack of sincerity to it.
I've been really fortunate to, you know, not have been to a lot of those restaurants.
But they exist,
but
right?
I do know that they exist, yes.
Yeah. I mean, there have to be people out there who have, like, there's craven motherfuckers out there, Jamie. There's people who sell out left and right. And people who see it as a means to, like, yeah, you want to get into restaurants, but people who are leapfrogging. People who have the fine dining restaurant and they say all the right things and they do all the right things because then they want to become, they want to get the New York Times like food section profile of them.
Right.
And then they get
and
their
then
own
sell books and then
and
sell,
they sell
a frozen
books and they're
food.
On Food Network and then they're fucking selling Gusto's corn puppies and shit. Right. Right? Like those people must be out there. That felt authentic to the world to me, even if I don't understand the specifics.
It's kind of a, I don't know. It's a silly model for success. It took me out of it. I just fundamentally have a problem with the idea that someone goes into fine dining at that level for any reason other than passion. And the other reason is ego. The other reason to get into it is ego. But if you're getting into it for ego, that like that's your reason, that's your reason for giving up your humble beginnings, and you are sure of it. Like I have a grandiose idea of myself, and that's why I don't want to be in a pub anymore. And it doesn't reduce you to tears. I don't know. There's something cognitively dissonant about that scene and that character to me. And then also the character of Robin is so extreme and so it feels like this melodrama, like, dude, live your fucking life.
Man, people get broken sometimes. Sometimes people break. I empathized with him. Like, I really did. We get the sense over the movie that it's not just that he lost his wife, but that, like, his wife was very heavily involved in the restaurant.
Uh-huh.
So, like, he lost his wife. He lost his partner. Anytime he goes to work, he sees the place that he and his wife built together.
What, like, I didn't get, speaking of the women who are very ancillary to this story, and that's another problem that I have with this movie, is just like, where are the women?
I mean,
they
yes.
don't exist here. This is a story about a broken white guy, and like,
it's also about fathers and sons.
Sure.
So like, yes, the women are ancillary, but then there are also a couple of really great female characters who really pop in the movie. The lady who is the running the truffle gathering outfit that Amir first takes Robin to,
and her like quick reaction,
she's amazing. She blows him off. She's like, I don't like sellers coming out here. And he's like, this is my friend. Somebody stole this truffle pig. She's like, motherfuckers. And then to all the other people out there, she's like, what's his name? Joey's in charge. If any of you motherfuckers fuck with Joey, I'm gonna break your fingers. Like, outrage that anybody would steal somebody's truffle pig.
Right.
She rules, and you get a whole like ethos from her, and a passion, and
it's
a conviction.
It's not as much about that anyone stealing somebody's truffle pig. It's people who she thinks are stealing that truffle pig to dig her sights.
Well, that
it's about her shit, which isn't a critique of the character, but like the character is on screen for a total of 5 minutes ish, if that. And then there's the baker woman who is that?
Who is that?
Yeah.
She was, I don't know, probably like his sous chef or something. She was someone who worked with him very closely in the restaurant, knew him, knew his wife. And then when his wife died and he decided that he just couldn't do it anymore, he left her the restaurant. She is so thematically tied to everything because she is the antithesis of, I have forgotten his name again, Finway. She's the antithesis of the Finway character, where she tries to continue doing Robin's thing. But then she tells him, like, I thought you were going to come back, so I kept the restaurant the way it was. But then you didn't.
And you're I'm a
chef
baker.
And I'm a baker. And like, she had to transform the thing to follow her own passion and to stay true to herself. She is not trying to become anybody other than who she is. She's not listening to fucking classical music because that's what her dad listens to. And she wants to seem sophisticated like Amir is.
Right.
You know?
And we get one scene with her where she's faced away from the camera, where the camera is like locked off and wide. And like, as opposed to the Finway character who we get in close up with his like big blubbering, chugging a glass of wine. Like it's
interesting.
It's uneven.
That is an unexpected critique. I don't think you're wrong. That is not the angle I thought you would have come at this movie from. Very interesting. Very interesting. But so you have a problem with Robin. I don't know, man. Like, not to get fucking morbid or anything.
Go
but
on
like,
ahead.
I get fucking morbid sometimes. And this has been a thing since I was a kid where, like, if I was, you know, like a little kid and, like, if my mom was late coming home from work, like, in my brain, I would fucking, like, imagine some terrible car wreck that she was in. And I continue to do that in my brain now. And, like, sometimes your brain goes down these terrible dark rabbit holes.
Sure.
And, Jamie, if I lost my wife and my son, like, I would settle all of my affairs and you would never see me again.
I don't think that that's true,
I would
Scott.
Fucking
I don't
buy 10 cartons of cigarettes and get in my car and I would just vanish. And that would be it.
I legitimately, knowing who you are and having known you for the past fucking age of men, I think that you would be very depressed. It would be devastating. It would haunt you for the rest of your life. There would, like, I'm not minimizing what that thing is, but you are still connected to a community. Like, these are not, you wouldn't become fully unmoored from the world. And not for nothing, but like our connection is, I think, important enough to keep you here and not like send you off into the woods, which, by the way, like, you can't just go off into the woods.
Well, I would need to get a truffle pick and then go to a place where there's truffles.
And live in a place where no one's going to kick you off the land. Or,
well,
because
he has a cabin. He has a little bit of property. So, but here's the thing about Robin, all right? What community, like, the way he describes the restaurant scene of Portland, it doesn't seem like he has any community that he feels connected to.
Except for the woman that he goes to.
Right.
Do you still make your salted baguette?
Right.
Like, there is affection there.
There is great affection for her and for the product, but they work together in his wife's restaurant. He clearly took his wife's passing very hard, and it was very difficult for him. And the idea of continuing to be around a person who would then continue reminding him of the loss of his spouse was too much for him to bear. But also, what else do we learn about Robin? And this is a scene that I really thought you were going to come in hot on. The fucking Fight Club scene.
Which I think is stupid.
It doesn't sit well with the rest of the movie. I think the scene is great in isolation. I think the performances are great. And I think the concept is like, it belongs. Like the pitch for this movie, when I first started hearing about it, and a lot of people responded to it this way, is like, oh, this is like Nicolas Cage doing John Wick, but with a pig. Like John Wick, his puppy gets murdered, and that's what leads him to kill the entire Russian mafia, right?
Okay.
And he goes into the city, and I guess, and I'm back, and I'm going to go and like kill a bunch of guys. But then it's not that. This movie is quiet and thoughtful, and it's not about violence, and it's not about revenge either.
No.
But the Fight Club thing feels like it doesn't exist in our world. I feel like the rest of the movie fits in the real world, and then the Fight Club thing, like, there's a movie called Fight Club that is detached from reality. It
right.
has its own, you know, set of rules, and this feels like it breaks it. But what do we learn from the Fight Club scene? We learn that Robin is someone who knows that he can walk into a room full of people who have worked in restaurants their entire lives and that someone would be willing to spend good money to beat the shit out of him. Robin was an asshole as a chef.
Yes.
He was probably your stereotypical screaming chef asshole.
Screaming angry chef.
Fired a guy after 2 months because he kept overcooking the pasta. Probably never took the guy aside and corrected him and trained him and showed him the right way to cook the pasta.
Right.
Like, Robin left because he didn't feel that he had anything. Because the sense of community that was there around the fine dining restaurant scene, something that he helped create, we get this sense that it's not a good place. Jamie, I don't know if you know this, But the restaurant
Shut
industry
the fuck up.
Largely does not have a great reputation
fucking problematic.
For nurturing and culturing the people who work within it.
Yes, that is correct.
Doesn't it make sense to you that, like, if this guy loses
no,
everything?
It would make sense to me if he became an insurance salesman or a fucking realtor. Like, that makes sense. Going off into the woods and being a whiny baby caked in mud.
He's not being a whiny baby. He's not whining. He's just separated. He's just pulled away from people. And he didn't, you said earlier, probably half an hour ago at this point, because we spent so much time arguing about one character.
Right.
But you said earlier that he left Portland and went into the woods to become a truffle hunter. And he left Portland and went into the woods to get the fuck away from people because he couldn't be around people. And truffle hunting is just a skill that he has that keeps him in food and batteries and like potable water, essentially. It's not like this is some new ambition that he's discovered. That is just a practical means to an end for him. And then he got this pig that he loved. He loved his pig.
He loved his pig. I think I would have less problem. I would have less problem suspending my disbelief on this movie if it leaned into the Fight Club aspect of it and wasn't so moored in the real world that we occupy. In the real world that we occupy, people don't up and leave and go into the woods.
Okay. People don't do that.
No.
You can think of no examples of people who do that.
I mean, there are people who like move out of the city.
Right.
And go to a more rural area.
Uh-huh.
But to have a hovel in the woods where you only cook over, like, it is extreme.
It is extreme, but it's not outside the realm of possibility.
No.
I mean, there's your friend and mine, Timothy Treadwell, The Grizzly Man.
Oh boy.
Basically did that.
Yes.
There's fucking, what's his name? The guy that the John Krakauer book and that the Sean Penn movie Into the Woods is based on.
Sure.
Like there are real people who do that. They're oftentimes white men, and that's probably a privilege thing. And that's it is probably 100% also just something about our thing, disposition.
Which is the other, like, I don't need to hear another story about this fucking privileged white man who's sad, who can't deal with his own emotions surrounding his own actions and the fact that his wife passed. If your spouse is the only thing mooring you to the, like, community that you live in, there's a fucking problem.
Yeah. That's why he left, because he realized that the community that he helped build was bad.
Sure, but
and
why
toxic.
Why am I sitting here listening to this story? What's interesting about it to me?
I found the character compelling. I think the Cage performance is beautiful.
The Cage performance is very good.
Cage is,
and the movie
really
itself
amazing.
Is beautiful.
I mean, it's gorgeously filmed, and the music is great, and yep. I love the look of it and the pacing of it. I really like the Amir character played by Alex Wolff. We just talked about Hereditary last week. Alex Wolff is the lead of Hereditary. He's extraordinary in that. Really, really talented young actor. I think the character is great and has this really interesting journey. And he's almost more of your main emotional through line. Like
he's the one who changes.
Well, I think they both change, but Rob's story is about revealing his past essentially. And Amir's story is about confronting and changing his relationship with his father. Rob is kind of like a vessel for Amir's emotional journey of confronting his father, confronting him being in denial about his mother's condition, and actually like having a real discussion, which kind of happens off screen, but like confronting his father about the business, about their relationship, about their toxicity between them, about the way the father like is
dismissive
and,
of him. And yeah. Yeah.
I think that's beautiful. I think the Adam Arkin character is beautiful. Adam Arkin plays
Amir's father
who has a name
like a mafia
movie.
Leader in the truffle world.
Yeah,
which is also fucking silly.
You don't think that there are like because he's
black
not like
market
a,
truffle dealers that will kill you.
Said he was going to kill him. The only threat was I will kill your pig. Which we later find out is a hollow threat because the pig is already dead.
Spoilers.
Jamie, anywhere there is money to be made, there are people. Like, let me.
It is not hard to get truffles, man. I've explained
to you how the restaurant world works. Let me explain to you how capitalism works now. I can
slap the shit out of you.
Okay. Anywhere that there is money to be made, there are people who are going to do shady, illegal, and unethical, and sometimes criminal things, sometimes violent things. To make more of that money, it makes perfect sense to me that in the world of fancy food and rare food items, that there are people who are willing to steal other people's fucking truffle pigs, even if it's just to like settle a grudge.
It's not just that the man is willing to steal somebody's truffle pig. It's that he's the mafia boss. He's the guy, he's the big bad. He's a man you don't want to make angry.
Yeah.
Like, I've bought truffles before. They come and they get you truffles. Like, it's not hard.
Have you bought truffles in Portland, though?
No. Admittedly, I have not bought truffles in Portland.
Just saying, maybe the Portland truffle scene is fucking hardcore, Jamie.
Maybe, right. But probably not. And also, their dining scene is not what is portrayed in this movie. But that's a nitpick.
The dining scene is not that they don't have restaurants where things are served with smoke?
They do, but like this movie is portraying a dining scene that can be best described as like fully up your own ass, like Michelin starred dining scene. And first of all, Michelin does not rate Portland. And second of all,
no one said Michelin. You said Michelin.
I did, but that is a particular level of cuisine and service and attitude and pressure that is congruent with what is portrayed in this movie.
In the one restaurant that they go to that's like that.
Right. But also the pressure, like the pressure that is depicted that we infer that Robin was under, and that we infer based on the level of violence that can be visited upon someone by the fucking truffle mafia boss. But more to the point, my time,
no violence. The truffle mafia boss threatens no violence at all. You are inferring things and labeling things on this movie that are not there. There is no physical threat of violence. The only physical violence comes either from...
I mean, he threatens to kill the pig.
He threatens to kill the pig, which is a hollow threat.
And he does, in fact, inflict violence upon Robin. The two junkies beat the shit out of him while they take the fucking pig.
The two desperate junkies
who
beat the shit out of him.
Hired by Adam Arkin.
I have a feeling that they were not hired to commit assault, and it was just their general junkie, you know, lack of coordination and proper
judgment.
But
Adam Arkin obviously didn't give a shit whether there was violence committed or not. The point is, Portland's a lot more laid back than all of this.
Right. I'm sorry. There's no crime. There's no violence. There's no junkies in Portland. No one ever stole a pig in the Pacific Northwest.
You a pain in the ass.
I just don't understand what world... It's because it's restaurants. It's because it's restaurants. And we're even dabbling in the suggestion that there's a seedy underbelly in restaurants. And now you're all like, it's not like this.
There is a seedy underbelly in restaurants, and it's toxic and it's horrible, but it's not a fucking fight club. None of this is my real beef. My real beef is I'm not interested in this desperate seeming privileged white guy. I'm fundamentally not interested in his struggle because, like, I'm sorry, grief happens to everybody. Lean on your community. Move on.
And if you feel that you don't have any sense of community, like you
but he obviously does. He obviously has community. He made huge impact. At the very least, we are shown proof that he has community in the woman who runs the bakery. There is affection and love between the two of them.
A place that brings him pain to even go to.
So get the fuck over. Get a fucking therapist and get over it. Deal with your emotions. Like, just more stories about white men who cannot deal with their own emotions. I'm sorry, I'm not that interested in it.
This is outlandish. This is very unexpected. Okay, fine.
I will say this. The scene where Rob is cooking dinner for himself, Amir, and Adam Arkin, whose character's name I cannot remember.
Yeah, he's just Adam Arkin.
The loving photography and the way that he moves in the kitchen.
The way that
and
he's instructing Amir.
Yep.
And he's showing him how to cook, which is obviously something that his like restaurant industry connected dad never fucking bothered to do. It's genuinely beautiful.
It's gorgeous. And the way he handles the bottle of wine, although as a wine professional.
I knew this was coming. You don't approve of the way he poured. Did you think his pours were stingy?
Not that. No, no. He poured it fine. He handled the wine fine. It's beautiful. And I do also love that the label, it's Cameron Pinot Noir, which is a Willamette Valley wine. It is very much of the place.
I liked that he said Willamette. You didn't need to correct Nick Cage the way I've been corrected
Willamette,
before.
Willamette, damn it. No, but he pulls one bottle of old wine from his cellar. Your whole plan could have been ruined if that bottle was corked.
All right. Never mind. We're never watching anything on this show about restaurants ever again. This was a fundamental mistake. You just can't see past your own shit.
No.
He was calling in a favor from a lady who was storing wines for him for 15 years.
All of this I could have forgiven if basically I was interested in the travails of our main character, which I'm not.
Well, that's very strange to me, and I don't understand.
He's a sad white boy.
Oh my God. Jamie, if he was black, would you feel differently?
I mean, if he was black, he would have behaved differently because he would have had to, because a black man out in the woods, like it becomes a fully different dynamic.
Yeah.
Like a black man alone in the woods as a truffle hunter would face a completely different set of challenges than Robin did.
Yeah.
As a white man. Like, any other race or class of person than, you know, straight, cis, het, white man. I said straight and het, and they mean the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Would have dealt with a completely different set of challenges. And that is, for me, why I'm disconnected from the beginning.
All right. Never talking about restaurant movies ever again.
The rest of the restaurant quibbles, that's like that. Those are hand waves if I'm invested in the rest of the movie. That's like a funny aside. Like, he should have had a backup because it could have been corked.
Do you at least buy in to Robin's very pragmatic, some might describe as nihilism, I describe as realism, his worldview, where he's talking about how roughly every 200 years there's a big earthquake off the coast of Portland and this city is going to be underwater soon enough, and we're due for one. But he is essentially talking about the existential doom that we are all facing in the form of climate change, and about how, like, you might as well be careful about the things you choose to care about, because we're not going to be here for very long.
Yes.
And it's important to care about things, but, like, make sure they actually mean something to you, and that when you communicate to other people, you actually show them who you really are. Otherwise, no one's going to give a fuck about you or what you say or what you do.
Yes, I fully agree with that.
I find that his whole worldview is profound, and he wouldn't have awakened to that had this pig experience not happened. Like, his whole journey in the movie is about, like, being forced to confront civilization again, and now he has to articulate the things that he has come to value in his time in isolation. And now he has to bring that newly articulated knowledge back home, and so he finally is able to, like, deal with his own grief and put on the tape and listen to that gorgeous fucking cover of Bruce Springsteen's I'm on Fire by his unseen deceased wife.
There's a lot to like here, but the main thrust, the whole thing, it's...
You just don't like the premise or the characters.
Yeah, correct.
Wow. All
that
right.
That is correct.
Well, I have one last question for you before we move on into the pairing.
Yes.
If there's a Philadelphia underground fight club scene...
Oh, my God.
How much money do you think people would pay...
To beat the shit out of me?
To beat the shit out of Jamie. There's somebody out there, right? There's got to be somebody out there who, if you walked into the Philly restaurant fight club scene
and said
on the right night, somebody out there, you don't have to name names, but you know who that one person might be.
Absolutely do.
How much money do you think they would throw down to beat the shit out of you?
I don't know. Probably a significant sum, if I'm being honest. And that's just the one that I'm thinking about. Like, I don't know, $5,000-$10,000.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's not walking around money.
No.
That's a chunk of change. Now, again, we don't have to name names, but I'm sure you have a Philadelphia restaurant professional who you, given the opportunity,
just fucking
pummel the absolute shit out of.
100%.
How much money would you spend for the opportunity to beat the shit out of them while they just stood there and took it?
$5,000-$10,000.
Five to ten grand?
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, this is why Jamie's finances are the way they are right now, everyone. Sound financial decisions like that one.
Oh, God. It would be worth every penny.
Yeah.
Oh, man, to just beat that guy's face into the... Oh, I can visualize it right now.
But the fight club scene isn't realistic to you at all.
Listen, man, that doesn't exist.
On one, you don't know that. Two, on the one hand, it feels like it belongs in another movie. On the other hand... Emotionally, it feels plausible to me.
Emotionally.
The whole concept, according to, you know, the urban legend created by the author, Chuck Palahniuk, I never knew how to say that man's name correctly. The concept for Fight Club came out of him, like, doing some, like, journalistic reporting about actual underground fight clubs. Like,
right.
This is just a nudge to the left of that, you know? This is just a specific industry, and you restaurant people have all kinds of weird fucking subcults and shit that you people
do. We just drink a lot of Fernet, and in Chicago, Malort.
And that's what you do, but maybe you just haven't been invited to the fight clubs yet.
Maybe. I mean, if they do exist, I don't want an invitation.
What if that one person is there, Jamie?
Sure, I guess. But I also don't want to ruin myself financially by spending $10,000 to beat his ass.
Yeah. Also, you probably can't throw a punch. Just guessing.
I mean, I've said it before. I was in exactly one fight in my entire life. It was in the 7th grade, and I lost.
Yeah.
So no, I cannot throw a punch.
Do you think this pairs well with Pig? Because I went far afield from my typical pairing strategy with this one. To remind you, you drunk, forgetful ass, and the audience, you told me this wine was tropical, delicate, regal, energetic, sparkling. Do you think this pairs well with Pig? I'm going to tell you right up front, almost all of my pairing choices here were contrapuntal.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing about this movie that is tropical. It is, in fact, the opposite of that.
It is the opposite of tropical, other than that, like, there's trees and it's humid. But yeah, it's not tropical.
Northern climes, yes. Cool climate.
I wanted something that countered the pervasive, heartbroken somberness of the movie. And I felt the tropicality would work tonally as well as regionally.
Movie is explicitly about like being not regal. The fall from regality.
Well, that's the thing. He's the king in exile.
Right.
He's the king of the Portland food scene. And any room he walks into, he has like even like his giant coat and like the way that he's framed and costumed, like he looks like the dirty hobo king who just like rolled out of a trash can.
Right.
He's
him and the hobo king from Under the Silver Lake.
That's right. They would be bros.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the regality, I think is a real thing for me in this movie. Even like Adam Arkin, Tani was comparing him to like the Pope of fancy foods. So I think there is a hint that there's a feudalistic quality to the power structures at play in the movie.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Energetic. This movie is like deliberately paced.
Yeah. It's not terribly energetic.
No. Sparkling.
It's not sparkling at all. Sparkling to counter the somber and the earthy and the sad.
Right.
And delicate. I think the movie itself is actually very delicate. It's all about these huge emotional things that happen in very small ways.
With the exception of the Fight Club scene, which is not at all delicate.
And even that, emotionally, what is happening in that scene? So like narratively, he's putting himself out there so that he can get beat up. In theory, he's getting the money, but really he's just exchanging his end of the money that he gets for getting beaten up for information about like how to follow the thread of where the new truffles are coming from, right, or whatever, right? But emotionally, what's happening there? He's proving to what's his name, the guy who runs the fight clubs, that his name still has value, because so much of the movie is about brands and about value and about, right, how you can promote
the first
and sell
time
yourself.
He goes to see that guy. Yeah.
Your name doesn't mean anything in this town.
Yeah. And he writes it on a wall and it means something.
Right. But he's doing that. But then also, what is the emotional exchange between him and the unnamed like waiter or server based on his wardrobe, the guy who puts down enough money to beat up Robin Feld? What is the emotional exchange that's happening there? It's possibly an act of penance for him. And it's also him voluntarily submitting himself to violence to give this man catharsis. Like all of Robin's encounters, even though he appears hostile to everyone that he encounters, every single character that he encounters in the movie, he gives some sense of catharsis to, including to that guy. That guy gets to feel good because he beat up somebody who he probably worked for and treated him like shit while they were working there.
Right.
I think there's delicacy to that. That's why I love that scene so much, even though like the world of it doesn't seem like it necessarily nestles into what's happening in the rest of the movie. But the emotional stuff is so potent for me that I can kind of like gloss over the ways that it feels like we're taking a genre trip somewhere else.
Hmm.
So anyway, those are all my verbal justifications for the pairing.
I think sparkling wine goes with everything. So yes, it's a pair.
Yeah. And I think especially once he gets back into Portland and once we like, especially like when he was sitting down for the, like the big restaurant scene where he fucking dismantles that poor man.
Finway.
Thank you again. I think it really plays there. And just for all of the rest of the scenes, like it was something nice to reach for. I don't know. Like normally I might've picked something that was like dark and red and super tannic and kind of musty and
right,
funky.
But the bubbliness of it does sort of counteract the dank, like petrichor of the Pacific Northwest.
I think it's a good pairing.
Yeah.
I think
you did a good job.
Accidentally. Well, not accidentally. I think it is it is a contrapuntally good pairing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good job.
All right. We've been doing a number thing, or I've been doing a number thing. Is this a 7 out of 10? It's 8 out of 10, 7.5, maybe a 7.5?
I think 7.5 sounds good. 7.5,
all right.
Like, yeah.
We're doing numbers now. 7.5 out of 10.
Yeah.
All right.
I like it. Does Tani have takes? Are there wife takes?
Oh, there are. She really likes this movie. She's a big fan. She doesn't have stupid thoughts about it like you do. All right, so let's do it. Wife takes. This is, of course, recreating my wife Tani's favorite way to gently antagonize Jamie at restaurants back when she and I used to go to the restaurants that he used to work at. He would serve us wine. She would come up with her own Somme-esque, flowery, pretentious descriptions of them. And that has just turned into a podcast game where she gets to ask questions vaguely about the wines and the movies and its funsies.
And she gets to say obnoxiously flowery things.
Yeah.
To befuddle and anger me.
Yeah. And I have not read any of these in advance. And that often leads to hilarity as well. So we have three questions today. Number one, which of the following is the best comparison to this film? A, Ratatouille, but Remy is a nihilistic recluse. Robin is not nihilistic, but okay. B, John Wick, but with devastatingly insightful world-destroying monologues instead of guns, and grout-nasty long undies instead of style. Yeah, his wardrobe is pretty gross.
It's so gross.
You do really wish that anyone ever said, like, hey, man, do you want to wash all the blood off your face before we go to yet another? Nope. Okay, we're just going to leave all that caked-on blood there? Okay. It's a look.
Also, he doesn't wash his wounds at all.
Nope.
The man is definitely infected and going to die.
He must smell so bad.
So bad. And he's sitting in this fucking, like, five-star restaurant or whatever.
Seemingly no one notices. They're all fake, Jamie. None of them are real. None of your restaurant people are real, Jamie. It's all fake.
That's fair.
And then C, Catcher in the Rye, except with good writing and a protagonist who is at least willing to remove himself from society after becoming an entirely self-involved shitbird with nothing to offer people around him.
I'll go with A.
You'll go with A?
Ratatouille, but the rat is a nihilist.
But the rat is a nihilist?
Yeah.
She offers a parenthesis on C here. Where did the ducks go in winter? Robin ate them right after not catching the children because fuck 'em, we all die. I've never read Catcher in the Rye. This is a reference that goes beyond me.
I've read Catcher in the Rye, but like I've largely forgotten it. And I remember something about ducks.
Yeah, my wife hated Catcher in the Rye.
It's not good.
And she very proudly will always mention that the only bad grade she ever got in school was when she wrote an essay that was essentially like, this book is fucking stupid. I can't believe I had to read it. And then went on for like 10 pages.
I loved it when I was a teenage boy. And then read it again as like a 20-something and was like, what the fuck is this?
Question two. Which of the following aspects of the character Robin Feld does this wine best pair with? A, absolute confidence. B, consummate skill. C, probably a concussion. D, zero fucks given to the point of complete fucklessness.
It's either A or B.
Because there's no concussion from this wine. And it seems like these people give a fuck. There's fucks to give.
They give all the fucks.
Yeah. I'm going to go with absolute confidence. This feels like a confident wine.
It's a very confident wine. They've been doing it for a long time. They know what it is. It gets served at the White House. Yeah. Absolute confidence.
Now, by the way, there are no right answers to any of these questions.
Right.
And then the third, I feel like we have dabbled in this territory already. Three, in the world of Restaurant Fight Club, are you, Jamie, A, bidding, B, being bid upon, or C, not invited?
Not invited.
We have already tread on all three of these topics. Yeah.
I have not been invited.
You have not been invited, or you have, and you remember the first rule of Restaurant Fight Club. And the second rule.
No comment.
There you go. That's a winner.
So next time on, for the food side of things, we're having a dessert, Scott.
This is the final installment of Jamie's Philadelphia tasting menu.
We're having a dessert. We're having the chocolate halva babka from Essen Bakery. I love Essen Bakery.
I love chocolate. I love halva. I love babka. I'm very excited.
What's to be upset about?
I'm very excited.
Yeah, it's super fucking good. It's among my favorite things in Philly. Essen Bakery has been there for, I think, now 8 years. I've eaten a bunch of this babka. This babka is responsible in some part for my gut. It's super fucking good. Tova Du Plessis is a James Beard nominated baker, and she is also an incredible person, and I'm excited to go downstairs and eat that right after we get off microphone. And with that, I paired Keller Rieslaner aus Lesa, 2018, which is available at Crush Wine Company at the time of this recording, for $35 in a 375-milliliter bottle. Dessert wine is expensive.
Ounce for ounce, Jamie, this feels like a lot.
Ounce for ounce, I mean, it's a $70 full bottle.
That also feels like a lot. The same amount, ounce for ounce. Well, Jamie, about this wine, you told me that it was luscious, Balanced, meaning high acid, again, serious sugar content. Bright citrus, the master at work, and deeply, deeply satisfying. I paired one of my all-time favorite movies, 1967's fucking masterpiece from the French comedy, just the GOAT, Jacques Tati. This is Playtime. It's the, I think, third film featuring Tati's signature character, Monsieur Hulot, and it is a borderline silent 2-hour kind of like epic comedy about the absurdity of modernity, and it is gorgeous and powerful, and to stay on theme, it has a show-stopping like 40-minute climax where Monsieur Hulot just stumbles into the opening of a new restaurant where the paint is still drying, and it is chaotic and brilliant, and everyone should watch it. Playtime is available as of this recording to stream on the Criterion channel. You can buy it on the VODs. God damn it, though, domestically, I can't just buy Playtime. I have to buy the whole Jacques Tati Criterion Collection box set, and I really just love Playtime. Like, the other ones are great, but I really just want Playtime. But I guess I might as well.
You might as well.
Because the Barnes & Noble sale is on. The box set would only just be $80
do
now.
Do the damn thing. It'll be great. You'll have your precious physical media.
But it's like, it's a big box, and I really just love Playtime. I just want to buy the one movie. Let me just buy the one anyway.
Oh, man. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Please, please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us with any comments, questions, concerns, or international reviews that you'd like read on air at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, follow the show, and also tell all of your friends.
And if you liked Pig and think Jamie is a dumb butt, please feel free to slide into his DMs and tell him about it. But don't tell him where the secret restaurant fight clubs are, because Jamie was clearly not invited for a reason.
Somebody wants to beat the shit out of me.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the people who like you are looking out for you and they don't want to see you get like brained too bad. That's hard to believe, too. This episode was produced and edited by me, that's Scott Hudson, and our social media presence is thanks to Jamie, that's him right over there.
Hi.
Our art is thanks to Ross Connor. Thank you so much, Ross.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you, we promise.